It's Wednesday, December 20th, 2006, and you're listening to episode 31 of Fear the Booth, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 57 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Booth. My name is Dan, and with me is Chad.
Hi.
Back from the Eastern Hemisphere is John.
Hooray!
And Adam.
Why am I introduced after him?
Because
you're less important.
Whatever. It's just like a PS.
But it makes no sense, because then I should be before Dan and Chad. So
find Brent at the bottom.
Yeah, exactly. You're like that warning label that they say at the end of the radio commercial. It's like, oh, by the way, this causes cancer. You'll die. As an aside, we also have Adam on a microphone here.
Hey, welcome to Fear of the Boot. It's Dan, Chad, John. This podcast also includes Adam.
Yes.
I didn't miss you. Oh, yes, you did. I heard the bonus episode.
You know, Dawn's better looking.
I don't know about that.
Dawn's also pregnant. John's still good to go.
That's true. I am.
It's true.
John's still
none
pregnant.
Of this
sullied by baby.
Desiring orange rinds and this sort of thing.
John is still a fallow field.
Oh, God, am I. Unplowed in the extreme.
All right, before we dig into the episode at hand, I want to take a quick moment just to thank our listeners back in bonus episode 11. We, of course, said that we were having a few struggles here at the show, which, thankfully, I think episode 30 turned out pretty solid. And I want to thank you guys for sending us in so many emails, for making so many forum posts, supporting the show, and expressing your thanks for what we do. So thank you guys for doing that, because this is a labor of love. We make no money off the show. In fact, we lose tons of money making this show.
And by we, I mean Dan, because he buys it all.
Pretty much.
Right. By we, I mean me and the family that suffers because of my addiction to this horrible.
Sorry, Carla.
So thank you guys all for what you wrote in to say. Now, John, before the mice were switched on, we've had in forums, either the Fear of the Boot forums or past ones I've been involved with, threads where we talk about people's embarrassing loves.
Yes, our guilty pleasures within the context of gaming.
Like, if you look through, let's take music for example. If you look through everyone's music collection, everyone has at least one album they would prefer no one else ever know about.
Adam has an ABBA album.
Boy, I really like that new song by Scissor Sisters. Don't Feel Like Dancing.
Who?
It's totally Euro pop trash. Who? Oh, well, go to Ireland and go to a club.
All right. There's a pop one down there.
I want to feel embarrassed for you, but I don't even know who they are.
I'll send you the track. It's horrible. I'm sure someone listening to this.
While you were in Europe, did you hear anything by The Hoff?
I did not, but I saw The Hoff everywhere. There were Don't Hassle The Hoff shirts across the continent.
Was there really?
Yeah, there were. None of the street vendors were selling them, and I looked, but...
oh, my.
No. I think he's bigger in Germany, but The Hoff is in Italy, The Hoff is in Poland, The Hoff is in Ireland. I didn't see The Hoff in Greece, but that's not to say he wasn't there. Wow. My powers of observation are much, much more limited than the Hoff's presence.
This is the worst thing America has exported since Fat Man and Little Boy.
I had a nice nuke joke, by the way. You should have said that for the Skies of Glass discussion.
Oh,
but anyway,
I'm deeply sorry.
I had a philosophy teacher who did a lot of his graduate studies in Germany, and from time to time he encountered European pretense regarding American culture, and his default retort was to go back to a clip of the Berlin Wall falling, the landmark event of modern European history, and David Hasselhoff pop music is playing in the background. It's like, this is how you mark the radical shift in your history. The Hoff.
Wow. Pray for Europe. but we were talking not about really embarrassing music, but carrying that on, John. You were talking about everyone's gaming guilty pleasures.
Yes,
so
our gaming guilty pleasures. Those one things that we know we really like to do on some glandular level, but wish we didn't enjoy. For example, my own is the venerable Dark Elf. It strikes me as stupid, Vampire the Masquerade-y, you know, oh, I'm a goth kid, look at my swords, but...
You have all the stupidity of an elf mixed with all of the annoyances of an emo.
Exactly. Kid. All of this unnecessary evil, this dark paladin woe that I loathe everywhere else. But when I play dark elves, like on EverQuest or whatever, I just roll one right up. And I like playing it, too. I don't understand why, but that's what it is. Nice. Dan, since you foisted this on me, what's yours? Come on. Little circle between us boys.
You know, actually, mine is pretty similar to Adam's. Which is despite
my answer.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to take your answer because despite everything that Fear the Boot stands for, I actually don't mind dungeon crawl games.
Hmm. Now, let me ask you to define that.
Oh, I mean
like you. What do you mean a dungeon crawl?
Oh, I mean
I don't need a story.
Temple of Elemental Evil.
No, you're not playing so and so the yeah. Great Mage.
Well, I mean, you may have a character.
That,
you may have
you're
a character.
Phytor.
No, I don't mean that. No. You're talking about
Phytor.
You're talking about a characterless game. I said a dungeon crawl. You could have a character, could even be a really deep character. What you're really talking about is the other end. The game master has no game. He brought with him the Undermountain box set or the Temple of Elemental Evil.
So I like Undermountain.
And you start at the level 1 toads at the upper level, and by the time you're done, you're level 15 or 18 way deep down there, killing the demon overlord that created the senseless maze.
So you're saying that you enjoy the game that is a map and a monster's manual, a whole honking yeah. handful of dice, and a pencil with an eraser.
Right, with
yeah, I do.
With some treasure and NPC prisoners and so on to run into along the way.
Dan, is Undermountain the one where there's a well in the back of a
yes,
pub and it
yes.
goes down forever? So, like, the adventurers don't even need to leave the stereotype you pub. Know, they just go to the
yes,
back room
that's
and
exactly
start.
Right. I could not quote to you all of them, but Undermountain has X number of entrances, and they're all enumerated in this box set, which I don't own, but Mike, who I game with, does own, yeah. and he has gone through all the entrances for me, and yes, one of them is a well right behind the end, so you can be at the end, you go out back to chase the guy that stole your purse who falls down this well, you fall after him, and when you wake up, you're in Undermountain.
You're on square D7.
Yeah, exactly.
Whoa. There are three toads in front of you.
There
what
is
do
an
you
exit
do?
To the north and to the east.
Games have lost the refined art of multiple entrances and exits. Like, in Zork, they had this, oh, well, you found another way out. That's awesome. And in Undermountain, too. Now you just go in.
Chat, what is your guilty gaming pleasure?
It's really hard for me to say because I really don't have any shame when it comes to making a character.
This
I'll make
true.
A pretty outrageous character and enjoy it. What I have the problem with is people hating my characters mm-hmm. Pretty universally. So,
well, that's because you like to be contrary.
Yes,
you
I do.
You are the most inflammatory person we know.
Mm-hmm. That's probably true.
Yeah, I can agree with that.
That's not a very good one, but it's an accurate one. I'm sitting here thinking, like, can I come up with something that Chad always tends toward that he shouldn't? And it's like,
well,
no, he's pretty shameless about the whole.
What's one character of mine that you've liked?
I have liked. You know, actually, I'm going to have to think about this for a second, just because there was this big hiatus where you and I didn't game together for several years.
Yeah, and I have a similar cop-out. It's that 80% of the time we game together, it's been you DMing.
Right.
Like, seriously, I'm scouring my mind just thinking of a character you played, a PC, and I can't do it.
I know who it was. Christian. Because what you set out to do was to prove that a bad character is not by trait. And mm-hmm. so you took all the bullet points that make the stereotypical
I made this
teenage
character. I was trying to prove
hormonal
a
character, where he was a pit fighter who had lost the love of his life to a rival, who had one cybernetic arm and one cybernetic eye and liked meat and all these things that make the stereotypically crappy character. But
he had blades in his fingers. And
but you went beyond that to actually say, can we take all these traits and still develop a good character out of this if we don't stop there? And which you did. And he was an outstandingly good character.
Thank you.
And I really enjoyed the game where I was playing a character alongside of him, which is actually one of the few games in our life where neither you nor I was GMing.
Right.
So that was really neat to do.
That was it was a fun character to play because I took all those bullet points of what makes basically a hard-ass character, somebody who doesn't have any personality or emotion but just has a lot of things, and the background is developed not to make a good character, but the background is developed just to make this person hard and tough and, ooh, he's so mean and badass. But I took all those things and I developed it realistically, and what ended up was a guy who was broken and insane.
Yeah, who was dealing with the consequences of what would happen to someone who went through that sort of stuff. Or, like you said, inside, he was a deeply broken man.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, in many ways, a very sad story.
Yeah.
And
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And you killed my buzz, Chad.
I'm sorry.
You made that character 10 years ago, and now I'm sad.
Well, no, actually, I made it 15 years ago?
Yeah, about 15 years. Yeah, oh, back yeah. before you and Adam were born.
Hey, nah. I was six.
I was...
You were nine.
Thanks.
No problem.
Now that you're back, I don't have to do math anymore.
Yeah, how
shove
about
it off
that?
To the younger generation.
Xbox Live contest is wrapped up. I just want to let you guys know that, so I'm going to be taking down that page. Thank you guys, all that entered. We will be giving away the last prize this week. And probably by the time this episode releases on Wednesday, someone out there has gotten a message telling them that they won. There is one game left, so I know what you got. All I got to do is get an address from you, and it's sent out. And I was surprised. The second to last pick.
Yeah, we said that the last pick was going to be the arcade games. Nobody's going to want those.
And it wasn't.
Yeah.
From the people I know that own an Xbox and play it, they have all said that they really do enjoy the arcade games on there. So the last game going out to somebody is Burnout Revenge. And I will just go grab that winner, and we will have that on its way.
I probably would have went straight for Burnout Revenge if I had an Xbox and was in the contest. Oh. I played three, and I thought it was a blast.
Yeah, I played one of the Burnout games. Couldn't tell you which one. I just love the alternate games, like the...
The crash mode.
Yeah, the crash mode.
That's what it's all about.
Your points is a dollar amount of the damage you've caused in the accident, and your goal is to get that as high as possible. I thought that was a lot of fun, the demented sort of way. I want to clarify something we said in the last podcast.
Uh-oh, here it comes.
Oh, my.
Is it a backtrack? Is it an apology?
No, it's none of the above. See, I think...
Excellent.
This has kind of come out with our gaming confessions. That here at Fear the Boot, part of the way that we argue is by...
Fisticuffs.
Overbalancing the counterpoint. If the problem within the community is that there's too much A and no B... We will argue completely in favor of B and point out the problems with A. And what we're actually shooting for is more of a balance to get people to see that there's virtue in all the different dimensions of role playing. And I think people tend to take that, and perhaps I think sometimes rightfully, sometimes not rightfully, to mean that therefore we hate A.
It's not rebellion for rebellion's sake. It is trying to bring up the lower to the standard of the one that's more prominent.
It's like Adam and I just admit, we enjoy dungeon crawls. Now here at Fear the Boot, we have never talked about dungeon crawl. Well, why is that? Because let's face it.
Chad hates Shadowrun.
This is what a dungeon crawl takes minimal talent to run, encourages minimal character development, and it's the easiest thing for anyone who's just gotten into role-playing games or who's been in it for decades and just is lazy about the whole thing.
He's talking about me.
It's the most prominent style of...
Yeah, it's the most
at least we feel. There's no demographic.
When we walk into a gaming shop or into a con and we wander around, look at the role-playing games going on, we don't see a whole lot of people working through backgrounds and character development. However, we see tons of people with their rollout map, and here they are in a 10-foot by 10-foot room with a bunch of kobolds, and there's a treasure chest.
Well, when people come up to you and tell you about their characters, you get a sense of what their game is like.
They tell you where they've been, underground. They tell you what they've been doing.
And what level they are, and all the swords
they've
got.
And they tell you what they got.
They don't tell you anything about who they're like or their internal conflicts or any of these things, you know, role-playing.
Well, let me ask you... Although, to be fair, I don't really care about that either. So,
true.
Let me ask you this. We've talked to a lot of people over the years, and even more people because of this podcast now. Have any of you guys ever encountered a person who told you a gaming story where the entirety of the gaming story is them telling you about their personality and their character and such?
No.
Yeah, I have.
I have not. Never once.
Outside of this group?
Outside of this group. My fellow psychodramatist style players have told me about their characters' motives and the historical circumstance that provoked them. And
yeah, I guess if you...
I don't know. It's just like any other gaming story, really. If you don't have the context of the shared experience, it kind of just makes you nauseous.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what makes the game...
I can't say that I have. Never once. But
then again, we don't know a whole lot of people who are like that.
No,
we don't know any LARPers. We don't know anybody who does...
And that's been part of our frustration, really.
Well, actually,
that
might not be something that is completely unexpected. How many gamers do you talk with that are outside of your gaming group?
I talk to a lot.
Well, here's the thing. Recently, honestly, not many. But over the years of my life, a ton. And that was part of what led to the whole thing with Fear the Boot, was as we'd go out there and talk to people. I mean, Chad and I, we used to at Archon every year. We'd talk to people, go to gaming shops, hung out with gamers that were not part of a regular gaming group. And our frustration is we could not find a soul on the planet that was into a storytelling, strong character game.
Now, does that mean those people aren't out there? Not at all.
No,
this just means we never ran into
purely anything. Argument through anecdote.
Yeah.
But we could not find those people out there anywhere.
Which was why when we started this podcast and people started listening to it and such, and then giving us feedback on the kinds of games they do and what they like and suggestions for shows that we can do and such, we were shocked, absolutely shocked that, oh my God, there's other
alone.
People out
well,
there who...
Well, after we got over the shock that people listened to us.
Yeah, besides Mom.
Well, I think that was part of the shock, though, was the fact that I did not expect anyone else to be into this. That, like,
right.
Oh, that's not an RPG if you don't have a big brainless fight whore. And
well, it's like the anecdote Skip, when Adam and this friend of ours, who his name is Skip, and he's a pretty old guy, and he's been playing D&D since before any of us at this table were born. And Adam was like, you know, we were thinking about pulling him into the group, and Adam was talking to him, and he kind of wanted to get in our group. And so the question was brought up, so what kind of gaming do you do? And Adam's like, you know, what kind of stuff you kill? And Adam's like, well, there's a lot of times when we don't do any combat at all. We just, you know, role play out the entire session. And he's like, you don't do combat? Well, that's not role playing.
And let's qualify. We do combat. In fact, we do a lot of combat. We just do other stuff, too.
And actually, John, that brings me to kind of what I was really getting at here, which is the current incarnation of we argue through juxtaposition, is in our last episode, we were talking a lot about, well, of course, the whole episode was about character role and role-playing game, and we talked a lot about our interest in developing non-combat roles in the world. Because the way that we see it, if you live in a world, and let's say even a post-nuke world or a fantasy world, whatever you want to talk about, yes, there's violence, there's heroism, there are these things out there, but there are also countless years that occupy the time between these things. And it's our frustration that none of these things are terribly well developed. And people seem
beyond just a simple difficulty roll.
Yeah,
done.
Exactly. That with combat, you have 200 pages for it and a map and charts and stat sheets. But when you get out of combat and you go home to run your local smithy, make a DC 20 save against smithing. You did well. Great job. Let's get back to killing. It's kind of our frustration that even though these things play prominently into the game world, you don't even have the option of playing them. There's no information on them. They don't tell you what happens in a smith. They don't talk to you about a smith's tools. They don't give you a detailed chart for the kinds of events in a smithy. You just kind of roll DC 20 and move on. And some people apparently walking away from that episode took that to mean somehow that either, number one, we are completely against combat play, or similarly, number two, that Skies of Glass was going to have no combat development in it, that it was just going to be this great big farming sim, and that's simply not the case.
Sim Farm was fun.
If you look at the field document, we talk in there about how major features of the game are suffering. The conflict of man versus man. These will figure prominently into it. We intend when we develop this game to give it a very robust combat system. Our frustration is simply that we don't see anything beyond that in most games. And with Skies of Glass, we would like to say, okay, let's say we release an area book for a particular state of the U.S. Well, we'll say, what are the major trades that go on in this state in our post-nuke world? And we'll pick maybe the top three. And here's 10 to 20 pages that explain what life is like in these industries and how they go down and rules for playing these out in detail. The example that we gave on the forums when people asked us about this, if you're familiar with the video game Harvest Moon, imagine giving that kind of depth to your guy operating a farm within a role-playing game. Now, this does not mean, hear me on this carefully, because some people seem to miss this, this does not mean that, therefore, the game is pacifist. This does not mean the game is about farming. This just means that you have other options. If you want to play the guy who's the bounty hunter, or who's the assassin, or who's the rogue, or whatever, who runs around the waste being the hero, shooting people, there will be tons of rules for that. What we're doing is offering you another option. Another thing we had people question is, well, does this mean the game book's going to be 9,000 pages long because you can't possibly develop all these things in great detail? Well, absolutely not. We said in the last podcast that you cannot write a game where every role is equal, where every role is fully developed. We're just going to pick a couple of the major features of life and develop them to be playable.
When I heard you guys compare this sort of system to Harvest Moon, I thought of other games like Ultima Online or EVE Online, where there is extensive crafting, there's extensive raw resource collection, but it ain't a walk in the park, and it's no snore if you want to get the best materials.
Yes, that's
you can
exactly
have a non-combat
right.
character exposed to extreme danger. I mean, ask someone who mined in Ultima Online before
right.
they introduced the PvP controls. It was tough. I did it. So
no, and if
stuck
for
yourself
example,
a little more, Johnny G.
Well, I killed them more than I mined myself, but I did a little mining too.
But you know, he's absolutely right. If for example, you want to play a guy who runs a trade caravan, well, you now have to contend with the wild animals, the raiders, and the hostiles out in the wastes. The fact that you roll into town and now the town is starving, so they're just going to rob you,
or
you get drawn up in politics because you're selling guns to faction A and now faction B is mad at you. Even the most passive lifestyles are going to have violent elements to them, and this game is meant to play those up.
Exactly, and in the chaos of the setting, we really want to eliminate mundanity as it is here on Earth. I mean, there's no raiders in the corn nowadays, but there will be.
Yeah, so I don't want to spend too much time beating this, but I just wanted to explain that there's a balance here that somehow I just think got lost in the last episode, and maybe that was our fault. Maybe this is just such a big paradigm-breaking thing for most RPGs that it's just foreign language when we say it. But just trust us on what we're doing here. We're not going to take away your ability to hurt things. Just that won't be the focus of the game. All right, today what we are talking about is story and history. And let me kind of drill down exactly what we are and aren't talking about. We are going to talk about, first of all, the macro history of your game. And what we mean by this is the big overarching story that leads up to the moment where you mean for people to start playing. For example, if we were making a Star Trek game, this explains how Starfleet formed and what happened leading up to the moment when you got on board your ship and went out on your first mission. We are not going to talk about this in narrow detail. So we're not going to talk about developing a history for a particular city or a particular planet, because this is a different topic we're going to hit later down the road when we talk about developing settings. So we are just talking about that kind of master story. The second thing we're talking about is that exact same idea moving forward, that as you look at your role-playing game and develop it for future products or novels or whatever you're interested in, how do you set up a story that takes this game forward into the future? Once again, not the story of a particular city, but the story of the whole realm as one great big entity, all the things that occur to everyone. So let's get into it. Let's start talking about backstory.
Let's start talking about backstory.
Okay.
I hadn't said anything in a while. And
that
I
was the interdiction of, I have a point, but
there was
you
no
really
point.
Didn't.
No.
Okay.
So, I hadn't said anything in a while. I kind of got lonely. Already.
So I think as punishment, or perhaps a reward, Adam should actually introduce the first point.
Adam should.
And discuss
go ahead,
it.
Adam.
What is the first point? Oh, the lack of such a history.
Well, what does that mean,
is
Adam?
That good or bad, Adam? Should our game world have absolutely no historical
context? I'm thinking that that's a bad thing.
I agree.
Thank you for agreeing.
No problem.
Didn't you put that point up there?
Thanks for showing up today, Adam.
Some games out there that are meant primarily as generic rule systems or portable rule systems, of course, are not going to have a backstory because there's also no setting. Mm-hmm. But as we've said throughout the series, our goal here is to develop a product that is a married setting and rule system. So we are always going to be speaking from that standpoint. So we have played some games, though, where there was either no backstory at all, mm-hmm. or it was far too small to really give you any sense of what was going on in the world.
Right.
D&D's default backstory is really hard to read. I've tried. It starts with anatomy charts, and then it ends with Josen raises a fallen friend in the index. I try to connect the dots
really?
With all the little pictures. Yeah. I'm sure it's trying to give me a history. Lita picking boxes, Mealy reading a scroll.
Nice.
Where did she get that scroll? Well,
where did she learn
how
to read?
I don't know.
And what does Mealy mean in her native tongue?
It's Elvish. It probably means happy tree hug song flower
no,
bird.
I think it means sprung from the earth as a fully formed adventurer who knew how to read.
Probably.
Age sprung 40, from, level one.
Sprung from two.
Yeah.
Sprung from pages on chapter two. Chrome wheeled, full injected, and stepping out over the line.
When you have a game that does not have a backstory, let's talk about kind of what the impact of that is. One of the biggest problems I have is that it does not set the context or the emotional paradigm of the game.
You mean the feel?
Yeah, yeah.
Let's just boil it down to smaller words.
But it's not entirely feel. Yes, it is feel, but feel, it's not entirely feel. When you take any kind of story, there is a certain emotional paradigm to it. For example, in Star Trek, when people encounter aliens, it's no big deal. All right, the individual aliens might be interesting, but the fact that you've encountered aliens is no big deal. However, when you take Independence Day and aliens show up, this is a big shock to the world. No one expects this or sees this coming. So when you create a game that has some departure from reality, which the vast majority of games are going to do, you have to have some sense of how the world has reacted to these unusual events that are unfolding. And when there's no backstory, you really don't get that sense. That, let's take Rifts. When the Rifts open and all these things occur, yeah, you have a few bullet points about this government fell and this government arose and these governments changed in these ways, but you really don't get a sense of what the social and emotional impact of those things really were. What was this like for, if I'm supposed to play a character who is really deeply rooted in this kind of a world, what sort of a person am I? How have these things set the context of my culture and created my sort of a emotional paradigm going into the world?
They talk about what is going on now, but they don't really talk about really where it came from.
I'd like to know how we got there.
Yeah. I mean, they do a little bit when they talk about like the coalition and such in Rifts. They talk it within the context of talking about what they are doing now. They hit a little bit on some of the factions, kind of where they came from or how they came about.
You know, that backstory, when it's gone, also takes away a lot of opportunities for plot hooks or for setting color to the world. Let's take American history, and let's say that in the back history of America, I mentioned in a few lines that, yeah, there's a civil war between the North and South and the North won, and then I move right along. Well, what I've taken away from you is that if you're playing in the mid to late 1800s, more or less late 1800s, that, well, now you're in a period of Reconstruction, where the South has a great bitterness towards the North, and the North has this sort of condescending view of the South, that the South should pay for what it did and treats them very poorly. And there's the desire of all these politicians to try and reintegrate into one stronger nation and all the problems leading up to that. So where if I choose to play a Southerner, these are my views of the world, or these are things that may shape my world, or these are the kind of people that I may run into going down the street, like the Union soldiers that are occupying the town, and here's my view of them, and here's how they're relating to
things. Well, here's your probable view of them. We would hate to give the impression that everyone in Zone B hates these trogs from Zone C.
Ooh, a pre-back track.
Yeah.
No, exactly, and that's completely right. But I just feel that when you take a game that doesn't bother telling a backstory at all, that you have given no context that someone can actually use in developing the character, developing their plots.
Well, when do you consider a backstory occurring? Do you consider a backstory occurring, we'll say Rifts or even Skies of Glass or even Shadowrun as an example, where there is a earth-changing event, Shadowrun, the Awakening, and Rifts, the opening of all the Rifts and the ley lines and such, and Sog, the bombs drop. Is the prehistory the events that occur before that catastrophic event, or is it the events that occur before the players start playing,
I think
including those catastrophic events?
Is going to depend upon the game. And let me tie that into one of my other complaints against some back histories I've read, which is irrelevance.
Mm-hmm.
And one example is in one of the histories I read of Battletech, they just carried on and on and on and on about the transition from the 20th century to the formation of the Starlink, which has no bearing on the game at all. And this is what I would use to answer your question as well, that I think what you have to ask yourself is which of these events are directly relevant to that which is going to occur in my game?
Mm-hmm.
Which of these set lasting feuds, pieces of culture, important points of history? And I realize there's some kind of fuzzy logic to this, because you could say, well, wait a minute, maybe A occurred directly before the game, but B caused A, therefore B has some relevance to the game, which may be true. But if you want to go from that route, well, you could talk all the way back to 4000 BC, this something occurred, which led to this, led to this, led to this, led to this, led to the space shuttle being launched.
A settler was spawned.
Yeah.
He typed B, and a city
and
showed up.
And created a city, and a worker spawned nearby. So it's a little bit of fuzzy logic. But I think what you have to ask yourself is what events and what bits of culture are still going to be major features of the landscape when the game begins. And these are the things that you need to focus your writing on.
You know what I like, too, is a game that has a very well-developed backstory beyond the points that we just talked about, because I like, as a game master and a player, to have the option that if I wanted to and the other players wanted to, we could play in that backstory before the events that revolve around the main part of the game, even if the game doesn't necessarily support it. Star Trek is a perfect example of that. The movies, the novels and stuff. In Star Trek, you have spaceships and aliens, and the Earth is like this sort of beautiful utopia, and it's a central one government and all that. But in the backstory of Star Trek, it talked about how the world fell into chaos, and there was a nuclear war, and there was all this devastation, and then there was these rise of these city-states, and, you know, and then the development of warp technology, the meeting of the Vulcans, and yada, yada, yada. Wouldn't it be cool to play in that sort of troubled time before the Federation?
There's a potential trap there in that you can get to the point where you have to develop everything as well as you're developing.
Well, yeah, that's true. Here's what I'm saying. I'm saying this from a player and game master standpoint. Even if the game does not support that, and that's fine. I don't think the game should support
it.
You should give people enough that if they want to do that, the feel is enough there to where you can actually run a game in that
feel. We do that very frequently with a certain game in this group, and it starts with B and ends in Adeltech.
I completely see where you're coming from. Really, my counterpoint was more to nuance what you're saying for the sake of the listeners, that you should not feel obligated to develop every point of prior history to be playable. You wrote this game with the intention that people are going to play it either in a specific era or maybe a pre-selected series of eras that, like within Battletech, they developed it sufficiently to play at 2750, 3025, and 3050 until we quit following the game. So,
as all good players should.
I hear what you're saying, that if you know that backstory, that may open up new avenues of RP or interest to you to go back and develop some of those other things.
Like in Skies of Glass, you could be the ones who caused the bombs to fall. Now, you wouldn't use any of our post-apocalyptic rules, but it's in the history, and it would be pretty cool.
Speaking of Skies of Glass, something that is we are going to have to be careful to dodge there, and you talking about Star Trek made me think of this as well. Using your own history to date yourself. Now, this is not a concern with a fantasy setting, but when you have something that is either modern day or just a little bit postmodern, like Skies of Glass is probably going to be about 130 years in the future. But when you are drawing a line up to that begins today in 2006, you have the real risk of dating yourself. We all laugh when we watch Star Trek and they talk about Khan rising up to power and forming his great evil world government with genetically engineered people in the year 1999.
Yeah.
Or I remember in grade school watching these films about these cities that were going to be on the moon in the 1980s or 90s.
Yeah. I remember when HAL 9000 was going to be built in Champaign-Urbana. I think it was in like 92 or 93. Yeah. I was like, all right, he's around. I got to kill him before he kills Dave Bowman.
We must kill him 14 years ago.
Yes.
With a post-nuclear game, we have the risk of drawing so heavily on what's in the news right now, terrorism and all these things, that when someone plays this game 10 years, 20 years from now, when the world has changed, they're just going to be laughing at it. The same way that now looking at a lot of the post-nuke things from the
past
several
years.
Most
of them are Cold War stuff.
Exactly. So the Soviet Union nuked us.
Which is a completely understandable from their perspective.
Right.
Absolutely. That's how it was going to happen. If we were writing this game today, it would be the war between the U.S. and the USSR.
We're not railing on or insulting those stories. We're just trying to make the point that don't repeat the mistakes that they made. If you write something that's in the near or future history, you got to be careful to avoid dating yourself. Now, how do you do that? One of the things that we would recommend is where you can be as vague as possible. The other thing that I would recommend is where you cannot be vague, be as original as possible. That if you write a game where you talk about, you know, terrorism from the Middle East, and then 10 years from now, something has radically changed in world history to where that's no longer an issue, which today we can't imagine. Just like in the 1970s, no one could imagine the Soviet Union being gone. But if something like that has changed, the fact that you now have it occurring from something else, like a reappearance of fascism in Western Europe or something to that effect, you've now not dated yourselves because you've gone down an alternate history.
There's a robust fascist party in Rome, but irrelevant.
Thank you for bringing that up, John.
No problem.
Glad you
I'm
came.
Just saying, it's there.
Glad you're back.
I also realize that some of this is going to depend on the game, because if you're trying to make a game that is about some specific derived event of current history, then you're going to date yourself. You can't avoid it. If you're going to make a game that's going to be about special forces fighting that war in the Middle East 5 or 10 years yeah. from now, whatever occurs in your game, you're going to date yourself. You can't avoid
right.
it. But that was your intention setting out, was to date yourself. Yeah. So it's going to happen. The last aspect that I want to bring up about the past story, which is going to push this into our next topic, is the fact that your past story sets up and implies some kind of future motion. If you have an intention with this game that it is not going to end at one source book, that there is going to be some future series of events that unfold moving your game along, then this has to come out of the backstory. One of the examples that we were kicking around before we started doing the podcast was, let's look at the Lord of the Rings movies. In it, you have this great big enemy of Sauron. Well, what happens after Sauron's dead?
The Fourth Age.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of it. There's really things. Yeah, you get the sense that things go on, but you really never get the sense that any of them were ever developed in great detail because they were irrelevant. But in a role-playing game, you don't have that. If you're trying to tell more than one single story and you set up one great big bad guy, well, what happens when he falls? It doesn't have anywhere to go. So with that setting, you may want to try and set up some kind of openings for future right. storytelling, and also give the sense that these are not static events. It's not like, well, these things happen and now nothing's going on, and eventually we'll kick out another source book that stirs things up again.
Well, I think you fall into that trap when you start making your feel or your setting about just generic good versus generic evil. You set up a few handful of evil bad guys or an evil bad guy to be knocked down.
Or similarly,
named
you have
people
a,
in feel bad.
Right. And then what happens when eventually the story knocks those down? Like in Lord of the Rings, which in Lord of the Rings, it's fine.
It was a novel.
A book has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Right.
And such Lord of the Rings did. But a role-playing game, you don't want to write a role-playing game like a novel. You want to have a beginning, and then the rest of the game is the middle. You don't want to have an end necessarily, because you're talking about life. Role-playing game is you're playing characters who are living in the whole concept is that it's just a living game that goes on and on.
Let's pause for a moment before we dig into the next topic, which is the future story. And let's talk real briefly about what we're going to do with Skies of Glass. Actually, we're kind of getting off easy, and here's why. When we set up this game, we chose to develop things at the local level. You know, we're not going to have the remnants of the United States government that's still exerting control from sea to shining sea. It just isn't there. And so we can focus on developing these local events, so that great big world history is only going to have limited impact on the story that we are trying to tell. Now, I want to emphasize, this is an idiosyncrasy of Skies of Glass because of the fact that there's a great big event that breaks history and because of the fact that it is locally minded. But the history we do put in there is going to be very focused on developing what led up to this event and then going back later. And this is going to be a topic of another podcast. We are, however, going to develop a huge amount of history for the micro setting. When you talk about an individual city, we intend to have tons of history and culture explaining what that city has been through. It just isn't going to be there at the global level because the global course of history has ceased to be. Globalism right. is dead. You know, you are now dealing with local cultures again. So that's what we're doing with Skies of Glass. Now, the future story.
Tell me about the future story, Dan.
The purpose of the future story is to
smooth.
move your game along.
A preacher. Should have him testify to it.
We can look at, let's take a series of stories here. Star Wars has an ongoing story.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Star Trek has an ongoing story. Battletech had an ongoing story. Most of
had. It stopped.
Most of the D&D settings have some kind of ongoing story.
Especially the Monstrous Manual.
After
A is B.
They release new ages and they release new events in history. The purpose of your ongoing story is simply to take the game somewhere else in the future. And this may be important to you to do because, first of all, it gives you the opportunity to keep developing the game. And secondly, it helps spice up the setting. Because after people have played that same game setting for so long, being a role-playing game, you can get a lot of life out of a game.
Right.
You can get decades of life out of a game. But people may eventually say, you know, it'd be nice if there was something a little bit different going on here.
I like salsa on my chips.
Some new stuff kind of coming in. I prefer queso to salsa, but Thanks for bringing
that
up.
Oh, I'm a salsa man.
Oh, I think Ab and I found the ultimate topping for chips.
Which is?
How do you say it in Spanish? What is it?
It was beans and cheese.
Oh, well, that's obviously not Spanish.
Yeah, that's queso. It's a dead split.
Frijoles and queso. No, no, no. It was beans and cheese.
And it's
mixed
that,
together.
It's that white Mexican drizzly.
Then the
cheese.
Vote is 2-1-1. Salsa wins. Continues this.
Huh. What a terrible turn of events here on the mics. Let's talk about the future story we have seen in some different games and talk about the problems we've seen.
Well, I think the problem you have with defining a future story is, at what point are you calling absolute present?
Yeah,
how is 3050 the future story? What if 3050 is where we want to start in 3025?
Well, and I think as you develop the future story, you create, in a sense, playable eras. Because someone can always choose to play before or after the release of a particular source book or a particular series of novels.
So would you say if you were designing a game that you would want to pick a 0 point?
I think so, yes. Or multiple 0 points, that is. There will be a 2750, a 3050, some point at which everything, horizontal and vertical, time and space, is developed far enough in each direction that you could plop a player down there and he could go somewhere.
I think that you kind of have, whether you want to or not, you have to, because...
Yeah. You have to pick a focus.
Well, there comes a point when you stop telling the story, put two covers on the book and hand it out,
right.
And then what was your last entry in the history
exactly.
section?
And assuming you move forward again, yeah. You have another source book where you take some other block of story, stick it in there between two covers, and ultimately you are telling the players, look, you can choose to play this source book or this source book. Or, depending on how you wrote them, maybe between this source
right.
book and this
yeah.
source book.
Or if you play number two, everything from number one is in there, it's just old now.
Right.
Yeah.
And you've always got to accept that players could play any of these, but if you are going to have these additional source books, you're developing some kind of forward momentum to the universe. And let's talk about a couple places I've seen this go wrong. One of the things I've seen is I don't see any real clear direction to the story.
That you mean just randomly putting out material isn't a good idea?
Yeah, exactly. It strikes me that they thought really hard about the first epoch of history, okay, whatever that may be. And then I really have the sense they never planned a future for this. It's just at some point later they said, you know, we should move the story along. And maybe somebody had an idea, maybe even a good idea. And they sat down and just kind of mixed things up a little bit and they put out another point of history. Well, one of the things I don't like about this is if you look at real life history, things always morph into something else. It's not like we have this particular age of history, stop, clean break, new age of history. These things all kind of move into each other.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing from pure storytelling, even putting realism aside, from a storytelling standpoint, if you have a sense these things are coming, there's always that element of foreshadowing and implied shadows gathering on the horizon, that things are going in some other direction that is not necessarily explicitly there in the current setting. That even though the explicit problem right now is this particular dictator, there's this implication that these three free states around the edge of this dictator's land are kind of going in some not too good directions. So even when this dictator falls, you get the idea, you know, these guys could be the next major problem.
Mm-hmm. And you want to keep those little things vague, so that the game masters have things to develop, to places to go, so they don't have to be locked down to your stories that you gave them.
Something else I've seen that goes right along with this is when they drop in some new story, they drop out the next source book, they have completely ignored their original feel.
Mm.
That the feel prior to this source book was real.
Give us an example, Dan.
Yeah, you know what it's going to be. You know, actually, I'm going to take a different one. Let's take Star Trek.
Don't know what it was going to be.
I do.
Chad knows what it's going to be, but I'm not going to do it because we use that game too much.
Oh, that game.
Right.
Okay.
I'm going to use Star Trek. If you look at Star Trek, you can take the classic Star Trek and Next Generation, where the feel of Star Trek was all about exploration.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really effectively a scientific mystery show. They go to some planet, some mystery occurs they cannot explain, or some alien comes up they cannot defeat, and they have to go through this kind of intellectual quest, figuring out what to do, and then they beat it, and then they move on. With the introduction of Deep Space Nine and Voyager, that feel is completely destroyed. And even if you liked either or one or both of those, this was about the time when Star Trek took a nosedive in its following. And I'm sure there's tons of reasons for this, and everyone's got a theory, but one of the things that certainly figured into that was they forever had changed the feel of what Star Trek was about. you know, I think if they thought about that a little harder and said, look, what is it that attracts people to Star Trek? Well, it's not necessarily just the setting or just the starships. It's also the kinds of stories that are being told within it. So you got to watch that kind of stuff when you put out something new. Make sure this not only comes cleanly off the history you've already developed, but also make sure that if people were enjoying your game because of aspects A, B, and C, that this doesn't suddenly destroy all three of those and take the game in some direction so different it might as well be a new product. John?
Agreed.
Very nice.
But to say, you've done a lot of talking, LaFonda.
Yeah, I know.
Down over there.
John, I want you to talk about new stuff that contradicts your existing canon.
Oh, yeah, there's also temptation in, especially the computer gaming world, the online computer gaming world, and the online computer gaming world produced by Blizzard Entertainment to... right over one's own canon.
First
in the
show back, you got that soapbox, Adam.
Revisions of what's going on, where you clarify these things into the opposite of what they were when they started. They do this in Warcraft a lot. The Draenei go from being this pitiful little decayed race to these robust. I used that twice. These burly paladins that are virtuous now, and the goblins are horrid, but they're neutral.
And you know, thing about Blizzard, they've even admitted this in some of their press releases.
Oh, they have.
The reason they have broken the canon is because when the game was written, there was no story. There was nowhere to go with it. That all they had in the first game was generic bad guy orcs fighting generic good guy humans for really no particular reason than the fact that orcs are bad and humans are good.
And, you know, when the game came out back in the early 90s...
I accepted that.
That's all you needed. That's right. All the technology would support. And that's all you wanted.
But then they tried to start telling some kind of story in Warcraft 2.
Which is a good
thing.
And a
lot of story in Warcraft 3. And even more story still in World of Warcraft.
Yes.
Plus the supporting novels and the planned movie and et cetera, et cetera. But they had nowhere for this to go in the first place. And this is exactly what we're talking about, that if you want to have some place to go, have that in mind. You know, leave some direction. Think about that forward direction. I guess something else you may also want to do is intentionally leave some things vague. If you define everything, you have given yourself no place to say, whoops, let's not do that. If there are no horizons left, you'd have no places for that new empire to pop up that wasn't there before.
I'm trying to figure out a way to get a lost Starfleet in disguise of glass. I haven't yet, but I'll think of it.
You're dealing with author resistance, not Star Wars.
Oh.
When you were developing the future story for your game, I would recommend doing it the same way that we talked about many episodes ago near the start of this show's run, developing the campaign outline for your actual sit-down RPG. Because we talked about with a campaign outline that your purpose should be to create a vision for where this is all headed, which allows you to do foreshadowing and all these other great things, but at the same time is vague enough and flexible enough that if at some point in the future your players broke your campaign because you meant for them to go west and all of a sudden they went and turned east, this is not the end of your campaign. And similarly, if you later decide that, hey, you know, we don't want to develop the story this direction anymore, we'd rather bring up this, you've got the freedom to go forward, but you still have all these great hooks and items and ideas that were already built in there, so you have something you can work with as you push it along. I will not talk you through it right now, but what we're going to do is we are going to post in our resources section the past story of Skies of Glass. And also, I'm going to post a few notes on kind of what we think for moving the game forward. Now, as we have stressed many times, the real story of Skies of Glass is being told at the local level. So I don't have for you, and will not for some time, any information on exactly what's happening in each city. But we have thought about and talked about having some kind of a broader world story. So I'm going to post for you what our current, and let me stress current, incarnation of those events is, just so you have something to look at when you're kind of seeing how we developed our story.
Okay.
Great.
I look forward to it.
So let's do some Skies of Glass Q&A.
This is the SOG moment where we have the little music that plays.
Zany morning show sound effects. Yep. We talked about in last episode that we're going to start adding a 5 or 10 minute segment to the end of our shows where we talk kind of just a Q&A on Skies of Glass based on the emails we've gotten or things people said in the forums where we answer some of the questions you guys may have about the game we're developing. And I have grabbed two questions that we are going to answer today.
Is one of them Mutant Gate?
Mutant Gate is in fact Mutant number Gate. One. People have asked us, are there going to be mutants in this game?
And people, Adam said no.
People didn't ask.
Well, but Adam asked. Thought that they
no,
meant
actually, someone did ask.
Wolverine oh, did and yeah, Cyclops, not my baby doesn't have
well,
any brain.
Let's define the different kinds of mutants here, just so we all know what we're talking about.
You're talking genetic mutations.
We're talking,
I'm not talking genetic mutations.
Yeah, okay, hold. In post-nuclear settings, especially like in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles after the bomb or something like that, or any number of them, genetic mutations in sci-fi and such means that people have fangs and wings and laser eye beams or psychic powers or
glowing yeah. green.
No, that was God
zombies.
Emperor of Dune.
Mutations are not an advantage. When your mom gets blasted with radiation and has you...
You don't come out better.
Yeah, you come out worse, if at all.
Remember that Family Guy when Adam West rolled around in the toxic waste to try to get Spider-Man powers? Yeah, this is what we're talking about here.
What happened to Adam West?
Nothing, but yeah.
Radiation poisoning. You're going to die.
Yeah, that's about it. So, in Skies of Glass, kind of someone asked us, are there going to be mutants? Chad said no. Oh, so Chad said yes. Adam said no.
Yeah.
These were not contradictory answers. Adam was saying no in the sense of the traditional post-nuke movie or role-playing game, magical, powerful mutants. They're not going to be in there. However, since radiation was around in significant quantities 50 years ago, there are still lingering effects where people are suffering from genetic degradation,
yeah.
which may mean babies are born missing an arm. And so,
or worse.
Or worse.
Horribly worse.
I'm thinking my answer was better, because when you take, for example, that people said, when people heard that we were having rules for farming, they said, you guys hate combat. My answer is more precise.
Your answer was no.
Yes.
And I
yes.
mean no.
Yes.
I somehow disagree. Carrying on.
The second question we're going to answer, someone asked how much of that pre-bomb technology is still going to be around. When we created this game, we're looking at dropping the A-bomb somewhere around 2080. So this game would take place somewhere in the neighborhood of 2130. And we got asked, okay, well, obviously by 2080, there were tons of high-tech stuff. How much of this stuff is left? Do people still have cars? Do people still have mm-hmm. electricity? Do people still have running water? And the answer is going to be this varies from place to place. However, for the most part, the answer is that this kind of stuff is scarce. You may find a city where they have reassembled a working coal power plant or something mm-hmm. of that nature and have electricity. These things will happen from place to place. However, across the globe, there will be extremely few places. We're right now thinking only one where a full pre-bomb society is in working order, right. complete with hospitals and cars.
And Starbucks and Frappuccinos and
right.
computers.
We're looking at there being very few, probably just one. Now, as you walk into a city, like I said, you could see a working coal plant, which means maybe people still have electricity, and someone might have some antibiotics, or they might have mm-hmm. working firearms of a fairly sophisticated yeah. nature. But these things are going to be, I wouldn't say super rare, but they are uncommon.
Or it might be you walk into a blasted city and there's cars everywhere. Do any of them work?
Run? Right.
Well, then that depends on the skill of your scrounger and the skill of your mechanic.
Right. I don't know, man. 100-year-old corroded battery?
Yeah.
I don't see a mechanic making that one work.
And this brings exactly. up something important that someone may retort, well, wait a minute, you're talking 50 years after the bomb. There was tons of this stuff everywhere. Society was built on it. Did it all magically disappear? And the answer is no. However,
some of it did.
Well,
yeah, our magic of vaporization.
Modern technology takes an enormous amount of infrastructure and maintenance. So when you have something like a car, yeah, the cars are all still there. But like John said, you're talking a 50-year corroded battery. You're talking the fact that you have no working gas refineries, much less some kind of method to get them to you. So a lot of these things simply aren't there. Guns. Let's say you have all these working machine guns. Well, if they haven't been very carefully cared for, mm-hmm. these things are now rusted and corroded to the point that they aren't going to work anymore.
They're like the Knowles rusted halberd, except they really shouldn't work.
Yeah, these really won't work.
Well, I think something that they should keep in mind is that just because population centers are completely destroyed, that implies that the supporting infrastructure
right.
for those population centers, which is the majority of the supporting infrastructure of this country and
right.
around
a simple,
the world, is also
well,
destroyed.
There's a simple equation. The more high-tech an item is, the more infrastructure it requires to maintain and support.
And that infrastructure is completely and utterly gone. And
right. Like, we're dealing with a future before we even get to the bombs. So, I mean, if everything is integrated with the nanotechnology hub and it goes to hell, then they're going to be worse off than we would now if we lost it all. And we've got to address that.
I think that part of the project, or part of making this project of Skies of Glass, is research that we're going to have to do. Some of these things we know already. Some of them we don't. We're going to have to research on how long does gasoline last, and you know, how long would a car battery last?
How long does center fire ammunition last?
Yeah. Like, I can imagine a car being perfectly fine as long as you keep rust away from it. Say it was in a garage that got buried, but the rubber is going to rot and the battery is going to calcify and destroy itself. Is the gasoline okay? And actually, as part of another game I was running, I know a chemist, and I was asking him, I was asking him, it's like, I'm running a game 50 years into the future where it's all destroyed and yada, yada, yada. How long does gasoline last? Can you pull gasoline out of a tank in a gas station and put in a presumably working car and drive away? And he thought about it, and he was like, well, if you look at these components of gasoline, they won't really separate. Though there might be sediment in the tanks, and you don't want to slurp that up. But 50 years from now, according to him, the gasoline should be fine.
Which we're going to re-research and see if we can find a petroleum expert or something. Well, I think that should wrap it up for the Skies of Glass Q&A. So thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
Oh, and if you have any more questions about Skies of Glass or anything for that matter,
just
head on over to the forums.
Yeah, feartheboot.com. Please stop by.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot. This show is copyright 2006, fully owned by its hosts. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in this show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.